Good morning. So nice to see all of you, both here at the OU Center and to those watching virtually on Zoom. Good morning. Tomorrow night is perhaps the highlight of my children's year, Lag BaOmer. But what is Lag BaOmer? What are we celebrating on Lag BaOmer? What is significant about the day? What compels hundreds of thousands of Israelis each year? Even Jews come from abroad, not this year perhaps, but certainly in previous years. Estimates of up to 500,000 people making pilgrimages up to Meiron, spending hours traveling on buses and in cars and sitting in traffic. What's this whole business of Lag BaOmer and Meiron and these pilgrimages? Why the bonfires? Mentioned that's the highlight of my kids' year. So already from Pesach time, you see kids in my neighborhood gathering together branches and even furniture, anything that will burn for the Medurah, for this bonfire that they're going to have tomorrow night. What is Lag BaOmer? Is it indeed the Yahrzeit of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? So this morning I'd like to explore together with you the historicity of Lag BaOmer. And we'll see together that it's really very vague, hazy, cloudy, nebulous. In Hebrew we might say it's Ma'od Me'urpal. It's very hazy. And I'd like to understand Lag BaOmer in the context of Yom HaAtzmaut and Yom Yerushalayim. Now, it's interesting. Lag BaOmer is not mentioned anywhere in Chazal. It's not mentioned in the Mishnah. It's not mentioned in the Gemara. It's not mentioned in the Midrash. It's not mentioned really anywhere in rabbinic literature, in Talmudic or Midrashic literature. It's not even mentioned in the Zohar. There are those who attribute the authorship of the Zohar to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. That's a whole other discussion. But Lag BaOmer as a date of significance is not even mentioned in the Zohar. So where does that date come from? Right? Where do we get this day of Lag BaOmer? So first take a look at source number one. This is a famous passage in the Gemara in Masechet Yevamot on Daf Samech Bet. You're all familiar with this passage. The point of departure for this passage is a statement of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva Omer, Lamad Torah b'yalduto, yilmod Torah b'ziknuto. Someone who learns Torah in his youth should learn Torah in his old age. Hayulo talmidim b'yalduto. If someone has students in his youth, yiyulo talmidim b'ziknuto. He should have students. He should teach Torah, raise up students in his old age as well. Shina emar. And Gemara brings a pasuk baboker, zarat zarecha. In the morning, you shall plant your seed, sow your seed, zarat zarecha, zarecha maybe. And the pasuk continues, and at night, al tanach yadecha, don't put down your hand. In other words, keep going. Study Torah in your youth, study Torah when you get old. Teach Torah in your youth, teach Torah when you get old. In fact, the Gemara there also, the Gemara says that the person should have children in their youth and have children when they get older as well. And some see that as the source for continuing to have children even beyond the mitzvah min haTorah, which according to Beis Hillel is to have a boy and a girl, to have two children, a boy and a girl, which would fulfill the mitzvah of pru urevu min haTorah. Some draw on this passage to say, oh, you got to keep going. That's what the Gemara there says. But in any case, the Gemara then relates, Amru, they said, 12,000 zugim talmidim hayu lo Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs of students. There are other versions, parallel passages that have it where he's got less, maybe only 12,000. There are different girsaot, and the story is related in different places. But in any case, he has 12,000 pairs of students, migivat ad antipras, from Givat to Antipatras, v'kulan meitu b'perek echad mipnei shelo nagu kavod ze laze. And they all died in this one period because they did not show honor, they did not honor one another. Okay. V'haya ha'olam shamein. And the world was empty. It was empty. Empty of Torah. the Masorah was in danger, perhaps. Until Rabbi Akiva went down to the rabbis of the south. Now, it doesn't mean necessarily the Negev. You know, at the time when Rabbi Akiva lived, the north of Israel, the Galil, was the center of Jewish life. So it could mean that he went down to the rabbis in the southern Galil. Vishina lahem, and he taught Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua, these five great sages. Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, and Rabbi Elazar ben Shimon. Now this Rabbi Shimon is Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, who we'll come back to. Hemidu Torah otasha'a. And they, these sages that Rabbi Akiva taught, they upheld the Torah at that moment. They replenished the world of Torah. The Gemara says the Torah was, or the world was empty. The world was devoid of Torah. The world was shamem. So Rabbi Akiva goes, and, you know, the context here, again, the point of departure is the statement that you should raise up students in your youth and in your old age. So the simple pshat would be that Rabbi Akiva by now was already older. Rabbi Akiva could have thrown in the towel, right? Rabbi Akiva could have retired. Except, what does he do? And especially after the damaging blow, the trauma of losing all of his students in one fell swoop. But what does he do? And this is really the intent of the Gemara here. He goes and he raises up five new students who then replenish all that Torah that had been lost. Okay? So that's really what the Gemara is trying to teach here, that you have to, you know, even after maybe experiencing such a tragedy, you have to go on. Even when you're, you know, a senior adult, you have to keep going. Baruch Hashem, a lot of retirees, you know, here, come to the OU Center. They don't say, I'm retired. Well, yeah. No, you got to keep going and learning. Tana was taught, Kulam mitu mi Pesach v'ad Atzeret. They all died between Pesach and Shavuot. There are Girsaot, there are other versions of this Gemara that have it ad pros Atzeret, until somewhere halfway to Shavuot, but no mention of Lag BaOmer. Right? Lag BaOmer is not mentioned here in the Gemara. So it's interesting. How, you know, how do we get to Lag BaOmer? Now, by the way, I mentioned that there are different versions of this Gemara that say different things, different parallel passages elsewhere in Safrut Chazal. The Gemara goes on to say that these students died of Askara, which is often defined as diphtheria, some sort of respiratory disease. Although there are those who suggest that that's actually code for the fact that Rabbi Akiva's students died during the Bar Kokhba revolt. And they're described as being 12,000 pairs because that's how they would go off to battle as pairs. So there are those who suggest that, you know, this whole Gemara here is really in code, and what is being described is Rabbi Akiva's students, they died because they were fighting along with Bar Kokhba against the Romans. We know from other passages in the Talmud Bavli and Yerushalmi that Rabbi Akiva was a supporter of Bar Kokhba. He believed that he could have been Mashiach. He's called his arms bearer. Rabbi Akiva is referred to as Bar Kokhba's arms bearer. Okay, he supported him. But in any case, for our purposes this morning, you know, there's no mention of Lag BaOmer here. Now, the earliest mentioned, the earliest reference to Lag BaOmer, at least in print, in manuscript that we have that's extant, as a date of significance, is from 12th to 13th century Provence. Here in source number 2, I put an excerpt from the Sefer HaManhig of Rabbi Avraham ben Natan HaYarchi. Okay, he was born in Lunil in Provence. Provence is in southern France, of course. And Lunil, right, related to the word lunar, moon. So that's why he's called Rabbi Natan, or Rabbi Avraham ben Natan HaYarchi. Okay? Yarchi, Yareach, moon, lunar, Lunil. Eventually he moves to Spain. He lived from 1155 to 1215. And we'll see, he mentions another one of the Chochmei Provence, an earlier rabbi who lived in Provence in the 12th century, a little earlier than him, Rav Zerachya Halevi, the Baal Hamor. And he writes the following here in source number 2. V'ach minhag b'tzarfat u'provencia, the minhag in France and Provence, which is southern France, liknos milag ba'omer v'elach. What does liknos mean? to gather, but someone said to marry. Okay? In the Lashon of Chazal, liknos is to marry. Hakoneset habitula, someone who gathers up or brings his bride into his home. A marriage is ultimately the kala leaving the reshut of her father and entering the reshut of the Baal. He gathers her up, he brings her under the chuppah. The chuppah represents her entry into the reshut of the Baal. So that's what it means. The minog is to get married from Lag BaOmer. In other words, the customs of mourning that we associate with the students of Rabbi Akiva, who, as we saw, died during this period, are suspended from Lag BaOmer and on. Okay? Now, it's a whole interesting discussion beyond the scope of our conversation this morning, but it would seem that while we attribute the customs of mourning we observe during this period of time, between Pesach and Lag BaOmer, some observe between Rosh Chodesh Iyar to Shavuot, this period we call Sfira, when we're counting Sfira to Omer, why do we observe customs of mourning? We don't make weddings, we don't take haircuts. We attribute the customs of mourning to the students of Rabbi Akiva, to the death of the students of Rabbi Akiva. However, it's interesting, it's been pointed out by many that it's very possible that many of these customs of mourning actually came much later. I've touched on this in previous classes here. There's a lot of evidence which suggests that a lot of the customs of mourning we observe actually begin following the first crusades of 1096, when the Jewish communities of Speyer and Worms and Mainz are decimated, what we call Kilot Shum, Speyer, Vermeisa, and Mainz. And then some even later, and that would explain, by the way, why there's a custom to begin from Rosh Chodesh Iyar, because that would be associated with the first crusades of 1096, which take place in Iyar. As you know, we say Av HaRachamim during this period, even on days when you wouldn't say Tachanun. On Shabbat, we say Av HaRachamim, right? On Shabbat Mevorachim and in Nisan and Shabbat Mevorachim Iyar and different occasions. Why do we say Av HaRachamim? Typically, we don't say Av HaRachamim when you wouldn't say Tachanun on such a day. And the answer is because Av HaRachamim was composed in the memory of those martyrs who died al Kiddush Hashem during the first crusades. And it's Dafka during this period of Iyar and Sivan when the Jews of Speyer and Worms and Mainz were murdered and those communities were destroyed. And so that's why we have the minhag to say Av HaRachamim. So it would seem that many of the customs of mourning actually begin to develop much later with the first crusades, and some even later, during what we call Gzerot Tach V'Tat, which was the Chmielnitsky massacres, which begin in 1648 in Poland. So there is evidence to suggest that the customs of mourning actually are later, but in any case, we associate them with the students of Rabbi Akiva. We attribute the mourning to the mourning over the death of the students of Rabbi Akiva. And so what the Sefer HaManahig is saying is that from Lag BaOmer, already the customs of mourning are suspended. V'shamati b'shem Rabbi Zerachia HaLevi, who I mentioned, Zalmi Gironda, he was from Girona. Shematzak katuv b'sefer yashan habami sarad. So now, here, he's referencing an earlier work. Rav Zerachia HaLevi, who I mentioned lives in Provence in the 12th century, found some sefer yashan, some older book that had come from Spain. Shemeitu mi pesach vad pros hatzeret, which says that they died from Pesach until pros hatzeret. The traditional girsa of the Bavli that here I put in source number one has they died from Pesach to Atzeret, from Pesach to Shavuot. Shavuot is called Atzeret, of course. So here he mentions that there are some versions that had it from the Gaonim that you have until pros Atzeret. That's when they died. Maybe about halfway. Pros is a partial. Okay? So meaning the customs are not the entire period of Sfirat HaOmer, but only partially, maybe half. Okay, but now he explains what exactly is pros. Umay pursa, right? What is partial? Palga, he says. He defines it as half. Half. Kiditnan shualim bilchot Pesach kodem lepesach shloshim yom. The Gemara in Pesachim says that you begin to ask and answer about the laws of Pesach before Pesach 30 days. Upalga tetvav yom. And half of that is 15. So he's defining pros as palga, which implies 15. V'tet vav, and 15 days, yom kodem hatzeret zeh lach ba'omer. So that's how he gets his calculation. Okay, so they had this tradition that, you know, 15 days before Shavuot is lach ba'omer. So already we have the Chachmei Provence record this tradition. It's an earlier tradition that already from lach ba'omer, the customs of mourning are suspended. And here in source number 3, the Me'iri, who also is a, you know, a little bit later, also one of the Chachmei Provence, he lives from 1249 to 1315, so he lives a little bit later on, just a little bit after Sefer HaManhig. He records a tradition that that's when the students of Rabbi Akiva stopped dying, that they stopped dying, they ceased dying on Lag BaOmer. The Sefer HaManhig doesn't spell that out explicitly, but the Me'iri here in source number 3 writes, V'talmidim elu, these students, Huskar Khan, who are mentioned here in the Gemara, this is in his comments to the Gemara that we began with, Shekulam mitu mipesach varatzeret, who all died in one fell swoop between Pesach and Shavuot, as the Gemara said, V'kabala biyar ha-geonim, and there's a tradition among the Geonim. Now, here it doesn't necessarily mean the what we would refer to as the Geonim, the Geonic period, you know, those sages of, you know, the 8th, 9th, 10th centuries, but it could be, you know, just earlier Rishonim. It's not clear exactly who he means, but there's an earlier source, like we had in the Sefer HaManhig, quoting an earlier source. There's or the earlier rabbis mentioned, Shebiyom Lamed Gimel Ba'omer Paska Hamita. So that's very important. This is the earliest date that we have, at least in manuscripts and in print, in the Rishonim of Lag BaOmer as a day of significance. That is the day when the students of Rabbi Kiva stopped dying. Okay, so then the obvious question is that then worth celebrating, right? In other words, do we celebrate a day on which people stop dying? It would seem almost morbid. Okay, all right, the Meitei Midbar, the Gemara at the end of Masechet Tanit explained they stopped dying. Okay, but do we really celebrate? Okay, it's a day when we don't say Tachana, and it's a day when matches were made. Yeah, the Mishnah says, Lo hayu yamim tovim liyisrael kechamisha sabav. Okay, it's a good point. But you could ask the question, because we'll see how we go from suspending the customs of mourning to actually celebrating and making pilgrimages up in Meiron. By the way, Adkan, no mention of Meiron, right? No mention of pilgrimages, no mention of the Chalakeh or the Upshirin giving the child his first haircut at age 3. So all it says is that on the 33rd day of the Omer, the Sefer HaManhig records that that's when we suspend the customs of mourning and we can make weddings. Okay? And the Me'iri affirms this tradition that on the 33rd day of the Omer, yes, the customs of mourning subside or are suspended. Why? Because that's when the students of Rabbi Akiva stopped dying. Shebiyom lag ba'omer paska hamita. Okay? And by the way, we'll see in the Shulchan Aruch, the Mechaber, the Shulchan Aruch himself rules that really the customs of mourning should therefore be suspended on the 34th day. Because if they stopped dying on the 33rd day, that implies that they still were dying on the 33rd day, right? Someone died on the 33rd day. So that would still be a day of mourning, and that's the difference between Ashkenazic practice and Sephardic practice. We can get a haircut on the 33rd day of the Omer. They wait until the 34th day of the Omer. Although this year, since Lag BaOmer falls out on Friday because of Kavod Shabbos, the Shulchan Aruch rules that they can get a haircut on the 33rd day. In any case, the Me'iri continues, V'noagim mitoch kach, and therefore the custom, because of this, is shalolita notbo, we don't fast on Lag BaOmer. V'chein noagim mitoch kach shalolisa isha mipesach ad oto zman. And therefore, you don't fast on Lag BaOmer, and the custom is that we don't make weddings up until this day. It would sound like that you can already make a wedding on the 33rd day. Although, if they were still dying on the 33rd day, maybe you should say, like the Mechaber, you shouldn't make weddings until the 34th day of the Omer. In any case, here in source number 4, the Shulchan Aruch, he writes, Noagin shalol isa isha ben Pesach letzert ad lag ba'omer, lag la'omer, mipnei shebotot zman meitu tamidei Rabbi Akiva. Okay, we don't make weddings from Pesach until Lag BaOmer, because during this time, the students of Rabbi Akiva died. Okay. And then the Rama writes that from Lag BaOmer, everything is permitted in Sif Bet. The Shulchan Aruch writes, as I mentioned, that you shouldn't get a haircut until really the 34th day in the morning. Why? Because, again, the assumption is that they were still dying on the 33rd day. So not all the customs of mourning, according to the Shulchan Aruch, are suspended on the 33rd day. You have to wait till the 34th day. And then where I've underlined, the Rama writes in Sif Bet, ubimidinot elu, eino agin kidvarav, ela mistaprin bayom lamed gimel, umarbim bo kitzat simcha, ve'eino rimbo tachanu. And in our lands, meaning in Ashkenaz, we don't follow this custom, but rather we get haircuts on Lag BaOmer. Now, the Rama writes that the custom is to wait until the day of Lag BaOmer. Mishnah Berurah points out that, however, in a year like this, when Lag BaOmer falls out Thursday night, Friday, even according to the Rama, you can get a haircut at night on Thursday night. Also, because of Kvod Shabbos, the Mishnah Berurah mentions that maybe a person is going to be busy. They're busy on Friday, so they can already, too busy to get a haircut. No one has time. They could, you know, they're busy with the Shabbos preparation. They can get a haircut Thursday night already. But in any case, the Rama mentions, again, the suspension of the customs of mourning, weddings, haircuts, and no tachonon, and marbin bo ktsat simcha. I make a little simcha, a little joy, a little joyous activity, a little festivity. What does that mean? Right, and so how do you get from Noagim Bo Ktsat Simcha to these pilgrimages in Meiron where you've got 500,000 people celebrating? Okay, that's the question, how that develops. And what's interesting is, we'll see a source in a moment from a contemporary of the Shulchan Aruch who describes already at that time in the 16th century there were pilgrimages up to Meiron, but the Shulchan Aruch himself doesn't mention anything about celebrating or making pilgrimages up to Meiron. The Shulchan Aruch lives in Eretz Yisrael. He lives in Tzfat, very close. So, maybe. So take a look at source number 5. This is from the Shar HaKavanot, from the Kitvei Ha'ari, the writings of the Ari HaKadosh, the greatest Kabbalists, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, Ashkenazi, and his ideas, of course, were recorded by his student, Rav Chaim Vital, 1542 to 1620. So, if you ask anyone what is significant about Lag BaOmer, what happened on Lag BaOmer, what are we celebrating on Lag BaOmer? If you ask, you know, what are you celebrating? They're not going to say, well, we're celebrating the fact that the students of Rabbi Akiva stopped dying. Because you can ask, is that really something you'd celebrate? It's almost morbid. I mean, do you celebrate, you know, other tragedies throughout Jewish history when people stopped dying? Okay, you mentioned Tu B'Av. Okay, so with the exception of Tu B'Av. If you ask anyone, if you ask my children, if you ask anyone in the street, they'll tell you, oh, it's the Hilula of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. It's the Yuritzeit of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. It's the day he died, which is celebrated as a Hilula. Hilula is a celebration which in Lashon Chazal refers to a wedding feast, a wedding celebration. Now, why is it called a wedding feast? Well, you know, it's the day when his soul wed heaven, so to speak. His neshama returned to heaven, so it's like a wedding in a sense. But the whole notion of the day being... Okay. Well, you could explain symbolically or spiritually the soul, you know, returns to heaven. The neshama is a chelek elukami ma'al, as recorded in Iov. The Chabad Chassidim add the word mamash, chelek elukami ma'al, mamash. It's a spark of the divine, and it returns to God. You could see that symbolically as a wedding, right? Not literally, of course, but in any case, this you know touches on maybe another question especially in the Hasidic world, but even among Sfaradim, the Yuritzeit is celebrated as, you know, a Hilula, the Yuritzeit of the Tzadikim, of the righteous. But in any case, what's interesting is it would seem that the whole notion of Lag BaOmer as the Yuritzeit of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is rooted in a mistake, in a printer's error. or an ascribal error. And so if you take a look here at source number 5, okay, where I've underlined at the bottom of the page, this comes, as I said, from the Kitvei Ha'ari. This is the Shar HaKavanot. We'll look at this more in depth in a moment, but he describes how he went with his Rebbe, the Ari HaKadosh. Rav Chaim Vital is writing and recording this. He describes how he went with his Rebbe up to Meron, up to the grave of Rashbi. And there it's described, where I've underlined, as the day of Rashbi's joy, B'yom Simchatenu, or if you turn the page, Zman Simchato, B'yom Lag LaOmer. So the 33rd day of the Omer is described as the day of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's joy, Yom Simchat Rashbi, Yom Simchato. And there are different versions of this passage that appear in different places in the Kitvei Ha'ari. And what's fascinating is it's been proven that this is the version here, as is printed on this page in source number 5. This is the original version. This is the version as it appears in the original manuscripts, just as it appears here in your source sheets, where it's a reference to Rabbi Shimon's Simcha. Okay? But along the way, it got misinterpreted as Yom Shemet Rashbi, or Yom Shemet Bo Rashbi, because the printer abbreviated the word Simcha as Shin Mem, with a Geresh, with a Chupchik. Okay? Printing was very expensive. Each letter had to be set by hand. It was a laborious and expensive procedure. So it was not uncommon for printers to abbreviate words. You look in many old Sfarim, and they, you know, abbreviated many words. And sometimes that led to mistakes. And such is the case here. So the whole notion of it being that Yom Shemet Bo Rashbi, the day of his death, the day of his Yeretzeit, is really rooted in a mistake, in a printer's error. And the original version, we have the original manuscripts. The Vital family is in possession of the original manuscripts of the Kitvei Ha'ari. And it appears just as it is here. And as I said, there are different versions in different parts of the Kitvei Ha'ari, which refer to Yom Simchat Rashbi, Yom Simchato. Okay? Now, some might say, well, Yom Simchato, Yom Simchat Rashbi is his death. Right? Some want to, it's a little forced, but some might want to interpret, okay, even if the original version is Simcha, the day of his joy, the day of his rejoicing, some will argue that, oh, of course, the day of his death is a great joy. In fact, in the Idra Zuta, which is one of the sections of the Zohar, as I mentioned, the authorship of the Zohar is often attributed to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, although that's a whole other discussion. But in the Idra Zuta, which is one of the sections of the Zohar, Rabbi Shimon's death is called a hilula. It's called a celebration, okay? So we asked before, you know, you asked about referring to a death as a wedding. So in a sense, yeah, his death may be considered a simcha. You know, the hilula of a tzaddik, the day he weds heaven, so to speak. The Zohar, in fact, describes this great elevation and elation that Rabbi Shimon has before his death, and how he reveals the deepest depths, the deepest secrets of the Torah, deepest mystical ideas with tremendous joy and simcha. So, you know, there are those who will say, no stira, inachinami, right? The day of his simcha refers to the day of his death. Okay, but it's not clear, okay? And there are no sources that we have. Again, it's not mentioned anywhere in Chazal that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai died on Lag BaOmer. It's not mentioned anywhere in the Zohar that he died on Lag BaOmer. Lag BaOmer is not mentioned in the Zohar. The day of his death is considered a date of importance in the Zohar, a day of great elation and elevation and joy, and where he reveals the deepest depths of Torah, the deepest secrets. But in any case, there's no reference to Lag BaOmer being his Yeretzeit. And in fact, some of the greatest Kabbalists have suggested that Lag BaOmer is indeed not his Yeretzeit. The Chidah, Rav Chaim Yosef David Azulai, who lived from 1724 to 1806, well, was a great halachist and legalist and and Kabbalist. He wrote many, many Sfarim on every topic. Many, many Sfarim. And he was a great bibliophile. He would travel to raise money for the yeshuv here in Eretz Yisrael, and that allowed him access to many of the great libraries of Europe. So he would examine all of these manuscripts, and he says very clearly that Lag BaOmer is not the Eretz site of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, as does the Ben Ish Chai, who lives from 1835 to 1909. You know, two of the greatest Kabbalists of the 18th and 19th centuries believe that Lag BaOmer should be celebrated as the day of Rabbi Shimon's joy, but they don't associate it with his death. So the Chida explains maybe it's the day he begins learning with Rabbi Akiva. We'll touch on that in a moment. Some say maybe it's the day when he received smicha from Rabbi Akiva. In fact, he was one of those five sages who Rabbi Akiva teaches, the Gemara tells us, in order to replenish the world of Torah. The world was devoid of Torah. Some say it was the day that he emerged from the cave. Okay, but some of the greatest Kabbalists of the 18th and 19th centuries admitted that it's not the anniversary of his death. You know, you'd say that in some circles. If you go to certain places, you go to Meron tomorrow night and you go around saying it's not his Yeretzayt, oy vavoy. They'll throw you in Cherem, or worse, maybe they'll throw you into the bonfire, Chas v'Shalom. But in some places, that's Kfira. But again, you know, some of the greatest Kabbalists and mystics admitted that. And they offered other interpretations. And in fact, I think what emerges from source number 5, which is such a vital source in order to understand the development of Lag BaOmer, source number 5 here, I think, is saying something very similar. That for those who celebrate, they're celebrating something different. They're not celebrating Rabbi Shimon's Yeretzayt per se, but they're celebrating his simcha. In any case, take a look at source number 5. He writes, Inyan minhag shenagu Yisrael lalechet biyom lamed gimel la'omer, al kivei Rashbi, the Rabbi Elazar beno, the minhag that Yisrael has. So by the time Rabbi Chaim Vital is writing in the 16th century, perhaps this minhag is already proliferating. We'll have to talk about how that minhag develops, but the minhag to go up to the grave of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son, Asher Kvurim Be'ir Meiron, who are buried in the city of Meiron, Kinodav Ochlim V'Shah, as is known, and they eat and they drink, Ochlim V'Shotim U'Smechim Sham, and they celebrate there. Ani Re'iti L'Morizal, he says, I saw my Rebbe, he's referring to the Ari HaKadosh, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, Shalach L'Sham Pamachat B'Yom Lag La'Omer, who went once on Lag La'Omer, who V'Chol Anshei Beito, he together with all the members of his household, all his family, V'Yashav Sham Shlosha Yamim, he spent 3 days there, Rishon shel haShavua haHu, v'zaya pama echad sheba miMitzrayim. Aval ein ani yodea im az hayabakiv yodea bechokma hazo hanifla sheisiga charkach. Just a skip for the sake of time. He mentions that he quotes in the name of Rabbi Yonatan Sagis, who is another important Kabbalist from the period, that in the previous year. So this was not the only time Rabbi Shimon, that the Ari HaKadosh went up to the grave of Rabbi Shimon on Lag BaOmer, but he gives testimony, this Rabbi Yonatan Sagiz, that in the previous year, Shalachti Ani Etzlo, Lilmod Imariza, that he went with the Ari HaKadosh to learn with him, and he went up to Meiron with him, Shaholich Et Beno HaKatan Sham, he brought his young son there, im kol anshe beito, with all the members of his house, v'sham gilcho et rosho, kimin haga yadua, and there he shaved his head, or he cut his hair, as is the known custom, as the custom is known. So here you have a very early reference, perhaps the first reference, to the chalaka at the grave of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Okay, this source is describing in early, perhaps one of the earliest pilgrimages that we have recorded to the grave of Rabbi Shimon in Meiron. And here is a source for the chalaka. Now, it doesn't say that the child is 3. So, you know, that's a separate discussion, why you wait till the child is 3. Some compare it to Orla. You can't benefit from the fruits of a tree during its first 3 years. The 4th year is Netta Ravah. You have to bring the fruits up to Yerushalayim and eat them there. But in any case, it's described how he cut his son's hair. And we're going to, by the way, we'll come back to this notion of the chalakeh in a moment. And he made there a day of feasting and rejoicing and celebration. Okay? And then we have this awful tale that's recorded. Okay, up until now, it's very positive. Gam heid, Rav Avram Halevi, ki bashana haniskeret. This Rav Avram Halevi also testified that on that very year, halach gam hu, he also went with the Ari. Halach gam hu sham, he went also there with him. V'haya noheg lomar, b'chol yom b'virkat tishkon nachem Hashem Elokeinu et avelei tzion, v'chulei. The minhag of this Rabbi Avram Halevi was to recite the Tefillah of Nachem every single day. Now we recite the Tefillah of Nachem when? On Tisha B'Av. Right? We ask Hashem to console the mourners of Tzion and Yerushalayim at Mincha time of Tisha B'Av. That's when we insert it into the Tefillah. But here this Rabbi Avram, he was reciting it every single day. Okay, look, he was mourning for Yerushalayim every single day, asking Hashem to console the mourners of Yerushalayim. However, the gam biyoto sham, amar nachem, when he was with the Ari HaKadosh and his family in Meron, he also said nachem. Now, how did the Ari know that he was saying nachem? Maybe he was the Shilech Tzibor. Or maybe he had Yeretzayt. It's a question whether it was Rabbi Shimon's Yeretzayt, but maybe he had Yeretzayt for someone, so he had to daven for the Amud. I don't know. In any case, he said Nachem, as was his custom. Okay? V'achar shegemar hemidu morizal, ki ra'a behekitzet rashbi, alav ha-shalom, omed al kivro. After he finished the Amidah, the Ari HaKadosh says to him that he saw in a vision Rashbi getting up from his grave, standing on his grave, the Amarlo, Emor el Haisha Ze Avram Alevi, Kilama Omer Nachem, Biyom Simchatenu. Say to this man, Rav Avram Alevi, why is he saying Nachem, which is recited on Tisha B'Av, on the day of our rejoicing, Biyom Simchatenu? Again, not on the day that Rashbi dies, Yom Shemet, but Yom Simchatenu, on the day of our rejoicing. Vihine Lachem, Hu Ye Binechama Bikarov. Not so nice. Rabbi Shimon curses the man and says that he will have to receive tanchumim. He will have to receive consolation very shortly. V'lo yatzah chodesh yamim ad shemet lo ben echad. And it wasn't but 30 days. In other words, within 30 days. 30 days did not even pass. And his son died. One of his children dies. This is an awful story. V'kibel alav tanchumim. And he had to receive comfort, consolation for the death of that son. The Kartavti Kol Zeh, and now Rabbi Chaim Vital is writing, and I've recorded all of this, I've written all this, Lohorot Ki Yesh Shoresh B'Minhag Zeh HaNiskar. I've recorded all this to show you that there is a source to this minhag of going up to Meron. So by the time he's writing, already it must be that the custom had proliferated to go and celebrate by the grave of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai on Lag BaOmer. Ubiprat, and specifically, ki Rashbi alav ha-shalom, and this is very important for our discussion this morning, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, blessed is his memory, alav ha-shalom, peace unto him, hu michamisha talmidav ha-gdolim shel Rabbi Akiva. Oh, why? What's the connection to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai on Lag BaOmer? Not that it's his Yeretzayt, but even Rabbi Chaim Vital says it has to do with the fact that he was one of the students of Rabbi Akiva. Not just one of the students of Rabbi Akiva, but the greatest of the students of Rabbi Akiva. Okay? There's not, you know, one perek in the Talmud where Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is not quoted. So he writes, V'lachen zman simchato biyom lamed gimel omer. Therefore, the day of his rejoicing, not the day of his death, as some misinterpreted based on a printer's error, but the day of his rejoicing is Lag LaOmer, the 33rd day of the Omer. Kifi ma shebi'er le'el biyom lamed gimel la'omer. He's explained elsewhere. As I said, this passage and similar references, similar passages appear elsewhere in the Kitvei Ari. So it's fascinating. What would emerge from this story, first of all, you see a description of an early pilgrimage, if not maybe the earliest description of a pilgrimage that we have. And it would seem as Rabbi Chaim Vital is explaining the reason for it. It has nothing to do with the Yeretzayt of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. That was a mistake. It has to do with the simcha that is generated from the fact that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was one of the students of Rabbi Akiva, and perhaps the greatest student of Rabbi Akiva. And during this period, all the students of Rabbi Akiva had died until Rabbi Akiva goes down to the south, as we read, and raises up five students, the greatest of which is Rabbi Shimon. So it represents the fact that the Masorah will continue, that continuity. Okay, so whether it's on Lag BaOmer that, according to some, Rabbi Akiva begins to teach Rabbi Shimon, or he gives him smicha, or Rabbi Shimon emerges from the cave, whatever it is, it has to do with the fact that now the task is on Rabbi Shimon to continue the tradition, to ensure the continuity of our Masorah. Rabbi Akiva passes on the torch, so to speak, you know, fires, torches. He's passing on the torch, so to speak, to his Talmud, Rabbi Shimon. Okay? So it would seem that that is the simcha that Rav Chaim Vital is describing here. Now, what's fascinating is that historically, Lag BaOmer, long before 16th century Tzfat, Lag BaOmer historically was a sad day. It was a tragic day. It was even a fast day on the Jewish calendar. And if you take a look here at source number 6, this is a passage from the Shulchan Aruch, Or HaChaim Siman Tav Kuf Pei, the very end of the laws of fasts, the laws of fasting. The Shulchan Aruch records, based on earlier passages, days on which historically Jews would fast. He writes in Sif Aleph, Elu hayamim she'iru bahem tzarot lavoteinu. These are days when tragedies befell our forefathers, and it's proper to fast on these days. And even though some of them, we'll see the first one, for instance, falls out on Rosh Chodesh, we still fast. There's an opinion that says you should still fast even on Rosh Chodesh. But you don't make up the fast on Rosh Chodesh. For some reason, you wouldn't have fasted, and you want to make up the fast, it wouldn't be on Rosh Chodesh. So he writes here in Seif Bet, Be'echad ben Nisan metu b'nei Aaron. On the first of Nisan, the children of Aharon died, the sons of Aharon died. Nadav v'Avihu, we read about it not very long ago, in Parashat Shmini, right? So, interestingly, just anecdotally, and we'll see that, you know, these fasts, many people don't even know about these fasts, but typically a bride and groom fast on their wedding day. Yeah, some say it's like the personal Yom Kippur. The real technical halachic reason is because we don't want them to be under the influence of alcohol while they're standing under the chuppah, okay? That's true. The chassan's eating and drinking and celebrating. Maybe he's going to indulge and have some alcohol. We want him of sound mind and body under the chuppah. But what's interesting is if the wedding is on Rosh Chodesh, right? So then the minhag is not to fast because it's Rosh Chodesh. We don't fast on Rosh Chodesh with the exception of the first of Nisan, Rosh Chodesh Nisan, as historically there was a fast on that day because that's when Nadav and Avihu died. So if the wedding is on, and I once performed a wedding on Rosh Chodesh Nisan and the Chatan and Kala fasted because historically that Rosh Chodesh, there was a fast on that Rosh Chodesh. Just an interesting anecdote. But then he continues, Basarabo, on the 10th of Nisan, Meta Miriam, Vinistaleka Be'er. Miriam died, and then the fountain or the well of water disappears. That was Bishut Miriam, and the Jewish people, remember, are complaining about water. Okay? And here, this is crucial for our conversation this morning. Bechavav bo Meit Yehoshua bin Nun. On the 26th of Nisan, that's when Yehoshua bin Nun died. Okay. So, as I said, here's a list of fasts that most people don't observe. Most people wouldn't even know about. Most people wouldn't recognize. You know, except maybe for Zion Adar, the 7th of Adar, which in some places the minhag is that the Chevra Kadisha fasts on the 7th of Adar, and then on Motzi, 7th of Adar. Afterwards, they have a special meal, a special Sudat Mitzvah, a special feast, so to speak. Maybe they make a Siyam to thank people for being involved in this Chesed Shel Emet, this very, very special mitzvah. Because the 7th of Adar is the Yahrzeit of Moshe. So that's how this custom developed. But aside from that date, most people wouldn't recognize any of these fasts. So they're not really observed nowadays. They were observed once upon a time. Some explain that nowadays our constitution, you know, there's a chalishat adorot, you know, we're not as strong as we once were, so fasting in general is difficult. There used to be historically many different fasts. Women and children used to fast. Mondays, Thursdays, people would fast. Okay, you could say, look, back then they didn't have what to eat. So fasting wasn't so difficult. They didn't have much to eat. But in any case, you could spend a lot of time on this passage here. Each of these dates is so fascinating. We could really devote a whole class to this. But in any case, for our purposes this morning, I've underlined the 26th of Nisan as the day when Yehoshua ben Nun died, and that was considered a fast. And I mentioned that this passage here in the Shulchan Aruch and all these dates are really based on much earlier sources. And the earliest and most authoritative source that we have a Geniza fragment, which says that, no, actually, Yehoshua dies when? On the 18th of Iyar, which is what? Which is what? When is, what is the 18th of Iyar? Lag BaOmer, right? The 18th of Iyar is Lag BaOmer. So what emerges is that we have this very early source. Again, the Shulchan Aruch has it the 26th. And these dates here, they're not always so accurate. In fact, the Magen Avraham, we'll take a look at in a moment here in source number 7, he corrects some of these dates. As I mentioned, there are many different versions of this from earlier sources and earlier manuscripts. So the Shulchan Aruch records that Yehoshua ben Nun died on the 26th of Nisan, and therefore the 26th of Nisan was a fast day historically. But the earliest version we have of this passage, and the most authoritative version, which comes from a Geniza fragment, has it that Yehoshua ben Nun died on the 18th of Iyar. So that means that the 18th of Iyar historically was observed as a fast day. And what is the 18th of Iyar? Lag BaOmer. So that means that historically, Lag BaOmer, for centuries, was observed as a fast day. It was considered a day of mourning and sadness. Back then, by the way, and this is maybe a challenge to the whole idea of celebrating the Yahrzeit of a tzaddik as a hilula, making a l'chaim, making a tikkun. You see that the Yahrzeits of the great Ishei Tanakh and our leaders here in source number 6 were not days of celebration, but were days of fasting. In fact, the custom was and is to fast on the Yahrzeit of a parent. So why do they make a tikkun? So yeah, you say l'chaim to the neshama, the different reasons given for that. People bring a little cake and a little schnapps to shul. But really, historically, how would you observe a Yahrzeit? By fasting, not by celebrating. And so what emerges from this source here is that Lag BaOmer was, for centuries, a fast day. It was a sad day. It was a day that the Shulchan Aruch says, a day where a tragic event befell the Jewish people, namely the death of Yehoshua ben Nun, and therefore it's appropriate to fast on such a day. And it's not just associated with the death of Yehoshua ben Nun, but there's another tragedy that happened on Lag BaOmer. Lag BaOmer was a day that, if I may say, will live in infamy. From the 4th century, there was a emperor, only for a short time, by the name of Julian the Apostate. The Holy Roman Emperor Julian the Apostate, who ruled from 361 to 363. In Hebrew, he's called Julianus HaKofer. Now, why was he an apostate? Because he rejected Christianity, and he wanted to return the Roman Empire to its roots, to paganism. And he dies mysteriously. He only rules for 2 years. He dies mysteriously. It's assumed that he was assassinated, but it's unclear. Scholars discuss and debate. But he was very favorable to the Jews. And scholars also discuss and debate why that exactly was. But he wanted to return things to the way they were, let's say, during the classic Roman period. And we have this account how in July of the year 362, he meets with leaders of the Jewish community when he's on his way to wage war against the Persians. And he asks them why they no longer offer animal sacrifice. And some explain that his interest was in getting a consensus around animal sacrifice because he too wanted to return Rome to, or the Roman Empire, to paganism and wanted to offer animal sacrifices as well. So he wanted the Jews, you know, the Jews were doing it too, right? Once upon a time. So he asks him, no, why did you stop? And he sends a letter to the Nasi at the time, who is Hillel II. By the way, he's the same Hillel that fixes the Jewish calendar, that establishes the Jewish calendar. And he writes of his intent to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash and resettle Jerusalem following his victory against Persia. Imagine, he wants to build, this is a Roman emperor who wants to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash and resettle Yerushalayim. And he says, well, it'll wait till I finish with the Persians, but feeling it could not wait, in Shvat of 363, he meets again with Jewish leaders, this time in Antioch, and they make concrete plans. Concrete plans are made. They discuss materials, architects, craftsmen, builders, and even a date to lay the foundation of the Beit HaMikdash. This is an incredible thing, and unfortunately, many, many people are not aware of this, incredible footnote to Jewish history. But then there's a major earthquake, which takes place May 18th to 19th, 363, which dashes their plans. And when was that? Lag BaOmer. Lag BaOmer of the year 363. And Julian dies in July of that year, July 26, 363, on the Persian front. As I said, some assume foul play, that he was assassinated. You can imagine he had made a lot of enemies wanting to return the empire to its pagan roots. And that sealed the fate. It wasn't meant to be. It was too soon. It was maybe as if there was a gzeira min hashamayim. It was just too soon to begin the rebuilding. So Lag BaOmer, from the 4th century on, also took on this hue or this tone of being a day of sadness and mourning. So we saw it was a day of fasting for the Yahrzeit of Yehoshua ben Nun, a day of mourning following this earthquake in 363. So how did it evolve into these celebrations, into these pilgrimages? Okay, so I'll share with you two theories. One theory is, and this is suggested by some scholars, that on or around Lag BaOmer, the 18th of the Iyar, between Pesach and Shavuot, right? There were Jews who would gather together around Meron, and they would rendezvous. That was the rendezvous point for their caravans, and they would proceed to make Aliyah LeRegel. We have accounts of Jews making Aliyah LeRegel for centuries following the destruction of the Second Temple. If anyone's interested, I published on the topic in the Tchumen Journal and in the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society on these Aliyot, how for centuries following the Churban HaBayit, post-Churban, there were Jews who would come to Yerushalayim. When they couldn't go on Har HaBayit, they would go to Har HaTzofim, Har Zeitim, and we have this recorded in many sources, and it's fascinating. I discuss in these articles what status that has. Is it real Aliyah LeRegel? Is it just a Zecher for Aliyah LeRegel? But the historical record is rich with accounts and descriptions of Aliyot post-Churban. So there are some scholars and historians who suggest that that's what is happening, and that's what evolves into the pilgrimages, that there were Jews. And by the way, I should mention that these sources that describe Jews continuing to go on Aliyah LeRegel and coming from all sorts of places around the world, it would seem that they came for Shavuot. They would come Dafka for Shavuot. We have a number of sources that describe Aliyah LeRegel Dafka on Shavuot. We don't have time for that now, why that was. But so some suggest that they would rendezvous there around Meron around this time, and that's what happens. Okay, there are other theories as well. If you take a look here at source number 8, this is the very beginning of a tshuva of the Radbaz. I'm just going to summarize for the sake of time. We're almost out of time. The Radbaz, a very, very important posek in the 16th century, important Rav and Dayan. He served as a rabbi in Cairo, in Egypt, and he comes to Israel and was a Rav in Yerushalayim. In Tzfat, he sits on the Beit Din of Rav Yosef Karo. So the Radbaz here is being asked a question from a father who makes a neder to cut his son's hair or to shave his son's head at the grave of Shmuel HaNavi. And all of a sudden, he's told that the place is in the hands of the Gentiles, the Muslims, and they won't allow Jews access to the grave of Shmuel HaNavi. What should he do? That's the question here. The answer is less important, but you see from this tshuva here, in source number 8, Radbaz is such an important post, he wrote thousands of tshuvot. You see from this tshuva here that what? That as we saw in the Kitvei Ha'ari, as was described there, how the Ari HaKadosh brought his son to Meron to get a haircut, there were other people giving their kids haircuts. Now, this was not in Meron. This is where? This is in Nebe Samuel, right? In Ramot, right? Right outside Yerushalayim. There's a whole dispute as to where the exact grave of Shmuel HaNavi is, but it's certainly not Meron. And so some scholars suggest that a practice developed, and we don't have time to get into how and why, possibly due to the influence of Sufism, which is a mystical branch of Islam, but there were Jews who were giving their kids haircuts in graves, okay, or in cemeteries by graves. You could possibly explain the connection to Shmuel as what? As maybe Shmuel was a Nazir, maybe that was the thematic connection. Shmuel was a Nazir, didn't cut his hair, maybe some want to say that. Not clear. But around the same time as these pilgrimages are beginning up north, we have a description of how there was this father who makes a neder and wants to cut his son's hair by the grave of Shmuel HaNavi, and he's not allowed access. And so some scholars suggest, oh, this is when the custom moves north. That the custom originated at the grave of Shmuel HaNavi, but once the Muslims no longer allow Jews access, so the custom moves north to another grave, to the grave of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Okay, they couldn't be by Shmuel HaNavi, so instead they went up to Rashbi. And you know that when it was difficult for Jews to get up to Meron, where they historically, where did they celebrate Lag BaOmer here in Yerushalayim? Anyone know? They would go to the grave of Shimon HaTzadik. As long as you found some grave and someone called Shimon. Some scholars suggest that this tshuva is proof that the custom originated with Shmuel. Once the Jews were denied access to that site, they would go up. Now, how does that connect with Lag BaOmer? So if you go back to source number 6, that important list of important dates, we have here, where I've underlined next, B'chafchet bo met Shmuel HaNavi. On the 28th of Iyar, that's Shmuel's Yaret site. The Magen Avraham amends that to the 29th of Iyar. As I said, these dates, you have a lot of different versions. So what happens is, you know, it's plausible. You had someone who wanted to give his son a haircut, who made an edit to give his son a haircut, maybe to coincide with the Yaret site of Shmuel HaNavi, which is in Iyar, only 10 days after Lag BaOmer. And he's denied access, so that custom, instead of now being associated with Shmuel, HaNavi gets associated with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai up north. Okay, around the same time of Shmuel's Yaret site, right, where we have a description of people giving haircuts by the kever of Shmuel, now all of a sudden maybe the minhag heads up north to the grave of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So those are just, you know, two different suggestions. There are other theories as to how the pilgrimages began. But in any case, we saw that by the time Rabbi Chaim Vital is writing in the 16th century, he's describing already a phenomenon that's taking place with people coming up to Meron, to the grave of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and celebrating there. Now that tradition or this custom only becomes more popular and more popular with more people going up to the grave of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Here in source number 9, and we're out of time, I'm just going to summarize this tshuva. We actually saw part of it last week when we discussed the concept of adding a holiday to the Jewish calendar. Can you create a new Jewish holiday? This is a tshuva of the Chatam Sofer here in source number 9. The Chatam Sofer lived from 1762 to 1839. He was the Rav and Rosh Yeshiva in Presburg in Hungary, which today is Bratislava in Slovakia. And in a tshuva on the sanctity, the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim, he turns his discussion to Tzfat and Meron. And he writes that he's very much against these pilgrimages up to Tzfat and Meron. At the time, you know, the many Jews were living there, and certainly they were coming en masse on Lag BaOmer from all over by then. Custom had really taken off. So he writes that he's very upset. He sees it as a you know, it's not nice to the honor of Yerushalayim that people are treating Meron like Yerushalayim, and they're treating that like a tel talpiot, and they're making pilgrimages to Tzfat and Meron. What about Yerushalayim? He sees that as a slight to the kavod of Yerushalayim. And parenthetically, he writes a hesped in his, which is collected in his drashot, about those who died in the earthquake in Tzfat in 1837, and he indicts them for forsaking Yerushalayim and settling instead in Tzfat, basically suggesting that they are the reason for the earthquake, that they bear responsibility for their own deaths. I don't know how that's considered a hesped. You know, make a hesped and you indict the people you're being maspit, but the Chasam Sofer could do that. In any case, so he's upset that people are making pilgrimages up to Tzad. What about Tzad Amero? What about Yerushalayim? So he's against these pilgrimages on Lag BaOmer. And then he adds that creating a holiday on a day when no miracle befell the Jewish people is also prohibited. Okay? Now we saw last week that according to Chasam Sofer, he writes it here in this tshuva and another tshuva, on a day when there is a miracle that a community or an individual experiences, they have a mitzvah to establish a holiday. And he goes on in this particular tshuva to say that that mitzvah is even min haTorah, to set aside a day and to give thanks to Hashem. What you do on it, it's midah rabbanan. It even goes as far as we saw last week to suggest that Purim and Chanukah, by their very essence, are midah rabbanan. What you do on them, mikra megillah or, you know, lighting candles, that is midah, that's what's midah rabbanan. But the idea of thanking Hashem and creating a day is midah raisa. So he indicts here, those who are celebrating Lag BaOmer, he says, on a day where there's no miracle. It's not mentioned anywhere in the Shasu Poskim, he writes. It's not mentioned by Chazal. No miracle happened. The only thing is, okay, we suspend the customs of mourning. But to celebrate it, he's very much against it. And he's not alone. Other Poskim, you have the Shol Meshiv of Yosef Shol Nathanson. He's upset with Baal Tashchis. You know, people go and they throw things into the fire. They want to get rid of materialism, right? Gashmius is a Rebbe who throws his tie, his necktie into the fire. Rav Avadi Yosef was very much against the pritzus, what he saw as a lack of tznius, men and women together. He also is concerned about the shchita. I went there once, just to be yotze. I went there once. I took my kids there, wanted to see what it was all about. Very loud, very, just very overwhelming. But I didn't see any shechita there. But Rav Avadia, I guess once upon a time, people would bring animals and shech them. He's concerned about the Velus at Trefus. They're shechting over there. So, you know, now that I have deconstructed the mystery and myth of Lag BaOmer and possibly deflated Lag BaOmer, I think there still is something worth celebrating. And you can still have your bonfire and, you know, roast your marshmallows. Remember, the whole point of departure for that Gemara in Yevamot that we began with was that you should raise up students in your youth and in your old age. And the Gemara describes how Rabbi Akiva had the strength and courage to do just that. How the world was shamem, it was empty, it was devoid of Torah. The Mesorah, our very Mesorah, was in jeopardy. But Rabbi Akiva went along and raised up five students, the greatest of which is Rabbi Shimon. I mean, Rabbi Shimon is mentioned in every chapter of Shas. There's not one chapter of Shas that doesn't mention Rabbi Shimon. He's so vital, so important, and played such an important role in the continuing or the continuity of our Mesorah when it was really in jeopardy. And, you know, I personally draw strength from this story about Rabbi Akiva because, you know, early on in my teaching career in the United States, I had Nebuch 2 students, young students, high school students that died tragically. It was very, very painful. Very, very painful. And so I drew strength from this account of Rabbi Akiva, and I continue to draw strength from the great Rabbi Akiva, who in his old age lost all of his students, but found the courage to go on and to raise up new students, even in his old age, to replenish the Torah that was lost and to ensure the continuity of our Mesorah, to ensure that the flame of Torah, perhaps, which is symbolized by those bonfires, the flame of Torah would continue to burn. And I think that is something that is certainly worth celebrating. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you all in Mirtz Hashem next week.